say a little bit about the 6 of 45. And that was get the components, get the designs. In those days, 45 megabits, as an example, silicon barely made it. Using a developer, the amplifiers, the precision circuits, the timing circuits, which permitted you to run at those rates. My involvement in that was development of the system, repeating. Trying to get your, find someone to get you the components, develop those components, so that you can go out, which permitted you to go with those rates. I then went off to work on the southern cable and renamed the answer your question on the technology. A whole can of worms starting with the fiber. How do you get a fiber which is strong enough to get it into the bottom of the ocean? How do you design cable which protects the fiber so it doesn't see the stresses of the deep sea? How do you get it in the water? How do you get it back out of the water when you've got to pick it up periodically and repair it? I shouldn't say periodically. There's a failure down below, you have to pick it up. How do you get the cable strong enough, the fiber strong enough to get it back up again? Staying with the fiber and the cable, or fibers in those days, we were talking about 2% strain on the fiber, 200 kPSI on the fiber. Typical fibers in those days were running a tenth of that, a fifth of that. It was a real, real technical challenge. Some great work was done at the laboratories in River Hill and the laboratories in Atlanta. The problem then of staying fiber, how do you splice the fiber together, make it splice strong enough so that it would survive again the cable and the rigors of the ocean? It's a very high strength. Splicing techniques had to be developed. This again was done very well. Chemical fusion techniques developed to do that. It's a great work. So we have a major program in fiber and cable installation techniques, splicing techniques, and get over into repeaters, and we have to get lasers, laser technology, detected technology, basic decisions had to be made on what wavelength to select for getting under the ocean, the terrestrial systems, as we call the dry land systems, we're using short wavelength, 820, 830. We rapidly concluded from the analysis we did that the system, though we couldn't cut it, we used that kind of technology. So we decided to use 1.3 micron single wavelength technology, and then development of fibers that not only had the strength requirements, but also created index instead of step index. The lasers were all short wavelength, we needed long wavelength lasers. The laboratories, people we depended on for laser technology, would up to their eyeballs trying to make a reliable short wavelength laser. There was actually very few people available to work on the long wavelength lasers, so we went to Japan, which was a move for the laboratories to get the lasers. Detectors, put it in perspective, up until that time, all undersea cables were basically minor modifications of existing dry land technology. We decided in the 1980 time frame, the existing, almost existing, dry land fiber technology, short wavelength, just wouldn't make it for southern cable. So we decided to leapfrog the dry land technology, develop the technology of 1.3 microns for the dry land folks there. A lot of people thought it couldn't be done, but we decided we had no choice. In fact, we never had no choice. Continuing to train what we had to do, so we had the lasers, detectors. We had silicon that ran at 280 megabits, and silicon didn't exist. the running system was only 90 in those days. The rollers had to be developed with reliability that was appropriate for the bottom of the ocean, which meant component reliability in terms of fits. They used in 10 to the 9 hours, unheard of for silicon in those days, unheard of for detectors, unheard of for lasers. So lasers, we had to develop reliability approaches, protection approaches. We used multiple lasers. We used protection switching under the ocean for the first time. We worked to basically get the requirements and reliability requirements on the phones back. We had to be, so you name it, we had challenges. Why were we so aggressive, which is another train, story that is not too well known. In those days, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, though they would deny it, had a had an industrial policy. What I mean by industrial policy is support of U.S. industry. They would deny it, since they did have an industrial policy. It manifested itself in supporting satellite transmission, which was a competitor under some cables. The reason they were supporting it was that the U.S. had a technological industrial lead in satellite transmission. So by encouraging satellite transmission, they were supporting U.S. industry. So they kept the books on how you calculate the cost of transmission by cable versus that by satellites in a way in which it favors satellites. And since the FCC in those days had a role in making sure the Bell system would provide the cheapest facilities possible to minimize the cost of the international communications, we wouldn't let the Bell system put in another cable. The other aspect of it is the FCC has social policy. The way the cost of satellite transmission was done, it cost the same to transmit a signal from New York to London than it did from Iowa to the heart of Africa. Of course, a dry land wet circuit from Iowa to the middle of Africa was very, very expensive compared to that of the satellite circuit. The cable circuit from New York to London was a lot less expensive than that from a satellite. And bulk of the traffic was big routes, New York, London, things like that. The FCC would look at it that way, prevented the system from putting in additional cables. So a couple of people, in particular a guy named Frank Tuttle, AT&T Long Lines, had great foresight, great vision, and decided the only way the Bell system was ever going to get another cable was to provide the FCC with competing technology. So we went to the FCC and proposed undersea cable using optics, and then the FCC bought in, and Bell Laboratories in effect told them he was crazy. He didn't take no for an answer. He came to Bell Labs in effect with an open checkbook and said, make it happen, because this is the technology and it was the right thing to do. And that result was a development program started in 1981, and in 1988 we were putting in cables across the Atlantic.